Oh, okay. I don't find it when you announce it anyway.
We're holding on page 88 in Shabbos, the paragraph labeled Def Tzedekeiyam Beis, so end of Ois Samachvav. The end of the parak talks about a couple of different types of beauty treatments, where there's machlokas Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim, whether those are malachas d'oraisa, and a person be chayv chatas or whatever for them, or whether they're only also d'rabban. So among them are godelas, which is braiding hair, and opekesis. And there's a few different explanations what opekesis is. It actually brings two explanations. One is that it means combing and smoothing out and parting her hair, and the other one is that it means using some kind of doughy type stuff, and you roll it into thin strings, and she puts it on her face in order to make the skin of her face appear redder and ruddier and healthier. It's definitely not allowed on Shabbos. The question is it also d'oraisa or d'rabban? Rabbi Eliezer holds these things are also d'oraisa, and the Chum hold d'rabban. So why does Rabbi Eliezer hold they're also d'oraisa? So the Gemara discusses back and forth, and it ends up saying gedela superkesis mishum boina, that both of these things are also on the grounds of boina. So the idea would be the braiding is in a way like building, because you're assembling the hair together into a braid. And the perkesis, according to the different possibilities, either again because she's combing and parting and whatever her hair, it's also in a certain sense similar to boina. Or there's the idea that in general, that any kind of beauty treatment that involves doing something to the body itself, for example, making her skin ruddier, would be included under that category.
Braiding forbidden for a woman because it might pull out some of the hair?
No, it's forbidden because we're saying over here it's a form of boina. According to Rabbi Eliezer, it's also d'oraisa, and according to the Chachamim, d'rabban.
How about for a man if he rolls his beard
up on Rolling his beard, I don't know. We're not talking about that. So the question is, v'chid derech binyan b'kach. The question is that considered building that Rabbi Eliezer should hold? It's actually also d'oraisa. And the answer is ain. As a matter of fact, yes, braiding can be considered a subset of building. K'didara Shub Shim Ben Manasseh. As Rav Shim Ben Manasseh darshins, that when the Pasuk says that Hashem took a part of Adam and made Chava out of it, and you have the Machlokas and Brachas that we already learned previously, and also in Erevin, whether it was a full-formed human body that was attached to him back-to-back, or whether it was an extra piece of him that then Hashem built up Chava. Anyway, the Pasuk says, Vayivin Hashem alekim es hatzela. The Pasuk says Hashem built up the side and made it into Chava. So the word building, melamed shekila, kodesh baruch hu l'chava, this teaches us that Hashem braided Chava's hair, ve'avia to Adam, and then brought her to Adam. So the poshta reason is because that way she would look more beautiful. So this is the idea to help out with chosin to help out a chosin kala, to help out with we say in morning davening hachnosas kala is one of the great mitzvahs. So here Hashem is showing is doing his part by making it that Chava should be as beautiful as possible for Adam. And where do we see that Vayivan means to braid hair? Shekain b'krake ayom, kurin l'kuliyasa b'nisa. We see that in the cities near the sea, the pashtus meaning on the coast of Eretz Yisrael, but wherever it is, their word for braiding is b'nisa. So we see that the word Vayivan can mean that he braided. So besides for the simple meaning that, in other words, we're saying over here that Hashem braided her hair in order that she would look more beautiful for Adam, there's a couple of explanations of the deeper idea behind it. One of them is that the same way as with a braid, you need three strands in order to make a braid. Two strands won't last. In the same way, you need three partners in a marriage. As we know, the Gemara tells us, each fish is awful. Shechina b'neihem. So therefore, the braiding her hair, meaning making three plates of it and then making a braid, represents the three partners, Adam and Chava and Hashem, who will go into their marriage. There's also an interesting point that Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz makes actually. He says the word kal'isa over here may not mean braiding, but rather putting up a mechitza, like the word kloyim, like the curtains in the Mishkan, meaning that Hashem put up a privacy curtain for them so that when they have relations, they'll be able to, even though it was before the chetei tzedas, and then need clothes, and v'lo yisper shoshu, and so forth. But we see Rashi mentions over there they were, in fact, doing it in front of everybody, and therefore the Nachash got jealous. So therefore Hashem was trying to forestall that, he says, by creating a privacy curtain for them. And that's another meaning of that Hashem made a shekila, kodesh baruch hu l'chava. Anyway, the point is, the Gemara is saying that therefore we see from that yes, braiding is considered a form of building, and therefore, according to Rabbi Eliezer, it would actually be also d'oraisa. And again, according to the Chachamim, and the Halacha is like them, it's not also d'oraisa, only d'rabban. That's what we're saying, because the word kali, the word in these krakei ayam, the word for a braid is binisa. So that's the thing. We're understanding that ayiven means not only to build, but also to braid. In fact, the Gemara in Brachos, when it brings this whole point, says that if you say that chava, if you say that the tsela that Hashem took from Adam is actually an extra appendage of his body, then it's easier to understand what ayiven means. Hashem actually had to build that part up to make it into a food. You have the Medrash that says that it was a rib. That's also the common translation of it. So yeah, Hashem had to build it up into a full human body. So then you could understand Vayiven in the simple sense. But if you say that Chava was already a fully formed human being, and all it is that she and Adam were attached back to back, and all Hashem had to do was separate them, then the Gemara says there, so what's the Vayiven? What's there to build up? And then the Gemara brings this to Rasha, that in that case, the Vayiven means that he braided her hair. That's what we're saying, because the Gemara explains there in Brachas and in Erevin that the word Selah can have two meanings. It can mean a rib or an extra appendage of the body. It can also mean a side, as in she was actually attached back to back to Adam as a full human being. So, yeah. Okay. Hazorik Perek Achadoser. The subject of this Perek is more dinim about carrying or transporting objects from one Rishus to the other on Shabbos. As we've learned before, everything when it comes to malachas, we learn from the way they did it in the Mishkan. So the Mishnah describes that the Levium wouldn't throw things from one the wagons themselves are considered Rishos HaYachid, wherever the wagons are parked when they're loading and unloading the Mishkan is Rishos HaRabim, but they wouldn't throw the Kroshim onto the wagons or off them because they're far too heavy. Instead, they would pass them from one person to the other, and therefore we learn from that there's a difference between throwing on Shabbos and carrying, that in certain cases throwing is potter, still also because it's potter because it's also with the Rabbanon, but handing something across from one porch to the other on the same side of the street would be chayav. So the Gemara goes into a bit of discussion in general about the malachas of Shabbos, and one thing the Gemara starts talking about is we have the story of the Mekoshesh Eitzim in Parshas Shlach. So they found somebody who was gathering wood, and they brought him to Moshe to be judged, and they didn't know what to do with him. And Hashem says you have to give him skill. So the Gemara starts by discussing what was the malacha among the 39 malachas that he was doing. And the Gemara brings two opinions. One is he was doing the malacha of gathering, of ma'amer, of gathering naturally grown things, like this is gathering sticks of wood. And the other opinion is that he was carrying four amas and Rishos HaRabim. So now the Gemara digresses then to talk a little bit more about the Mekoshesh. So Tanan Abanan, Mekoshesh Zet Slafad. Who was this Mekoshesh Eitzim? He was none other than Slafad. We have later on that his daughters come with a claim and say, we want our father's inheritance. How do we know that? Because you have the Pasuk says, when the Jewish people were in the desert, then there was this guy who broke Shabbos. Then you have a different Pasuk, when Bnei Slavchad come with their claim, they start by saying, our father died in the Midbar. So therefore, we have Xeda Shabbat. Ma lahalan Slavchad afkan Slavchad. The same way as over there, this is Tzlofchad's daughter was talking about their father. The same way we have to understand that the Mekoshesh was Tzlofchad as well. Divir Rabbi Akiva, that's how Rabbi Akiva learns. However, Omalei Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira, Akiva, Ben Kacho Ben Kach Ata Osid Litin Esadim. Whichever way it is, whether what you're saying is correct or whether what you're saying is incorrect, either way, you're going to end up having to answer in front of the Beis Din Shamayla for what you're saying. Im kidvarecha, because if it's like you say that Slavchad was indeed the Mekoshesh, look, HaTorah kisasei, the Torah covered it up. The Torah did not identify him by name. Va'ata megala, he's saying you're revealing who it is. You're revealing something that Hashem obviously didn't want us to know. So what do you think you're doing? And if you're incorrect, then you're saying something derogatory about that tzaddik. Now, fine, okay, you know, relatively speaking, his daughters come to Moshe and say, Ovinu Meis Bamidbo, they say, Bechetoy Mes, but still, why should we assume, says Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira, that his chet was such a severe one, something that is chayiv, something that's chayiv misa, something that's tantamount to violating the whole Torah. So therefore, so Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira says, Rabbi Akiva, don't be saying that. But the question is, what's the problem? Rabbi Akiva learned it from Gzeira Shava, and Gzeira Shava is tantamount to something that says explicitly in the Pasuk. If Hashem himself put those extra words in the Torah here and there, and he told Moshe to teach to the following generations that this is how you learn things, and that's practically speaking, as though it's written, Befedosh in the Torah. So what's Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira's problem with it? The answer is Gzeira Shava like Gomer. The answer is Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira had not learned this Gzeira Shava from his Rebbeim, and therefore he disagrees with Rabbi Akiva on it. So Tosfos asks, so what's the problem? So why can't he accept the Gzeira Shava from Rabbi Akiva? And the answer is Tosfos says that the Chachamim had they knew there's a certain number of Gzeira Shavas. Every one of the Chachamim at that time had learned from his Rebbeim that there's X number of Gzeira Shavas in the Torah. So that means and he would know all the slots are filled. So he doesn't have an available slot for an extra Gzeira Shava. That's how Rashi learns, and that's how Rashi and Tosfos learn. With that said, the Oruch and some other Rishonim learn kind of the other way around. They say the vote is Rabbi Akiva had not learned this Gzeira Shava himself. We usually say a person can't come up with a Gzeira Shava on his own, but especially first of all, in Agadta, there's a little more leeway. But second of all, you have places where it says that a person can come up with his own Gzeira Shava where it's to strengthen something that he already learned. So a person already learned something from his Rebbeim, but there's no source for it in Torah Shebichsav, then he can come up with his own Gzeira Shava to buttress it. So according to the Oruch's way of understanding, that's the other way around. Rabbi Akiva knew from his Rebbeim that's how it is, that's Slafad. Therefore, he created this Gzeira Shava, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira is telling him, what do you think you're doing? Now, besides that also, Rabbi Akiva is not necessarily bothered so much by the fact that it's Motzi Laz al Osid Tzadik, because you actually have a point that Tosfos makes in Bava Basra. This story about the Mekoshesh is also brought in Bava Basra in connection with the discussion about Slafchad's daughters and all the Jinnim that we learn from their story. Tosfos mentions over there that actually the Mekoshesh Eitzim was not doing it with the plan just to violate Shabbos because he felt like doing it. Actually, what it was is that this was right after the Chet HaMeraglim. People were thinking, you know what, we're stuck in the desert for 40 years. Why do we have to bother keeping mitzvahs anymore? If Hashem has pretty much Chas V'Shalom abandoned us, and not really, they still have the money and whatever, but if Hashem has sort of given up on this generation, then we can do whatever we want. So therefore, he davka goes and breaks Shabbos in order to demonstrate that, no, you still have to keep all the mitzvahs, and if you don't, then there are serious consequences. There's also a sikha, actually, where the Rebbe talks about the idea. We know that Al Pichsidus, the Chet Meraglim, was that they figured that we can't go into Eretz Yisrael and have to deal with the Gashmiistic world. We have to stay in the desert in our world of pure Ruchnius. So therefore, in other words, they figured that that Ruchnius is more important than Gashmius, comes along Slavchad and demonstrates to them that that Gashmius is just as important. Well, first of all, you know, they had learned that from the Chet Meraglim, that now that you can't do that, you can't reject the Gashmius of Eretz Yisrael, but now also that you see that don't think on the other hand that all you need is Gashmius and Ruchnius is not important either, and therefore he's going to go and violate Shabbos in such a way and then have himself put to death to demonstrate to them about the importance of Ruchnius as well, that you need both in Avodah. Anyway, the point is, so therefore Rabbi Akiva is not really so bothered by the idea that this would be Motzi Laz on Slafad, because after all, he had a good reason behind what he's doing. Okay. So the Gemara says, Ela Mehecha Hava. Well, according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, how did Slafad die? After all, the pasuk says Bechetei Mes, he died for his own avera, and they make it clear he wasn't among Adas Korach or among the other times when people en masse complained against Hashem. So what was it? So Mimidbar Deveyapilu or Mivayapilu Hava. He says that Slavkot was one of the Mapilim. So after the Chet HaMeraglim, you have it in Parshas Shlach, and again, Moshe repeats the story in Parshas Devarim that after Moshe has told them off in Hashem's name that they're all going to die in the desert and so on and so forth, and now a lot of them were feeling thoughts of Tshuva. The Alter Rebbe talks about in Perek Chavtes of Tanya that you see from this that a person yells at his Yetzirah and puts it in his place, and that breaks the Yetzirah. So now they believe in the Eibishter again. They believe in the power to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And some of them are going to say, let's go up the mountain and we'll storm into Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe warns them, don't. Hashem's not with you, etc. But they go anyway, and a bunch of them and the Knanim go and defeat them and kill many of them. So according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, Slavchot is one of those guys. What about then? The fact is the Torah doesn't say him either, so doesn't he have the same problem that he's identifying somebody that the Torah didn't? Okay, but the fact is that's not as big an Aveda. To be part of those Ma'apilim is not really as big a thing as breaking Shabbos, which again is tantamount to breaking Kola Torah Kola, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira is not bothered by saying that he should be one of that, that he could be one of the Ma'apilim. No, so wait, what? The Magdefa after the Chet Meraglim was only the Meraglim themselves. The Meraglim themselves died, the 10 bad Meraglim died by Mageifa Lifnei Hashem. They did. Many of them were, that's what we're saying, many of them were killed by the Kananim. And according to the Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah, Slavkot was one of those who was killed. No, that's according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah, he wasn't the Mekoshesh, that's the verb. Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah is disagreeing with Rabbi Akiva. He's saying, I don't believe that he was a Mekoshesh, that he was the Mekoshesh, even if your Gzeira Shavah is right, and he was. The fact is, I didn't learn this Gzeira Shavah, or you didn't learn this Gzeira Shavah, as the case may be, and therefore you have no business saying it. But it may even be that's not true. I myself, Bechlal, don't hold that he was a Mekoshesh. I hold he was born from the Ma'apilim. Baal HaTurim on the Pasuk actually points out the word Vayapilu over there is the same gematria as Slavkot, which gives us a remez for the effort of Yehuda ben Maaseiah's idea that that's who he was. Okay, the Braisa continues. Kayotze b'davar ata omer. There's a similar kind of thing where Rabbi Akiva darshins about one of the figures in Torah, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah again criticizes what he's saying. The Pasuk says, in Parashas Baal Loscha, so you have Aaron and Miriam are speaking against Moshe, and then Hashem goes and then and tells them off. They have to realize how special Moshe is compared to every other Navi. And the Pasuk says, Vayichar af Hashem bom vayelach. Hashem was angry at them, and then he left. So them is Aaron and Miriam. Melamachach Aaron Nitzdara, Divrei Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva says that means that Aaron was also struck with Tzaras, even though the Pasuk only mentions that Miriam was, but actually Rabbi Akiva is saying Aaron was as well. Omalei Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah, and again Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah says to Rabbi Akiva, Akiva ben kach or ben kach ata osim litin esedin, whether you're correct or whether you're incorrect, either way you're going to end up having to answer for what you're saying in front of the Beis Din Shamayla. Im kidvaracha Torah kisosai, again, because if what you're saying is correct, fine, but the Torah still concealed it, and therefore you shouldn't be revealing it. And you're revealing it. Being lav, and you're incorrect. At a motzi laz, alois a tzaddik, then you're saying something derogatory about that tzaddik, about Aaron, which is incorrect, because then you'd be saying that he got tzaras when in fact he did not. So again, the question is, well, what is Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah doing with the word bom, which means that Hashem was angry at both of them? The answer is, Ahu ben Izifa ba'alma. Rabbi Yehuda ben Maaseiah would say that doesn't mean that Hashem actually struck both of them with tzaras. It means that just Hashem was angry and rebuked both of them. But as far as the tzaras, that struck only Miriam. Now, why tackle would that be? So Maharsha explains. So how did the whole thing start? We talked about a few days ago about how the Jewish people were told to separate from their wives before Matan Torah, and Moshe meanwhile made a Kal V'Chomer for himself to realize that he should separate from his wife permanently because he's always on call and Hashem could call to him and give him nevuah at any moment, and he doesn't want to be in a state of tumah. So what happens where in Parshas Baal Uli or in Parshas Baal Oso, when the 70 Skenim are chosen and the ruach of Moshe rests on all of them and they become Nevi'im temporarily, so Miriam and Tzipora are standing together, and Miriam is saying how fortunate these people are and their wives that they have nevuah, and Tzipora is saying how unfortunate for their wives, now they're going to separate from them like my husband did from me, and therefore Miriam understood, Miriam realized what happened over here. Tosfos explained earlier, till now she knew maybe that Moshe had separated from his wife, but she thought that Hashem had told him to explicitly. Now she discovers it was Moshe's initiative, so therefore she and Aaron started talking and saying, why does Moshe think that he's any better than any other Navi? So now, though, the point is that she is the one who initiated the whole thing. So therefore, she's the one who got the main saras. And then Rabbi Akiva is saying that since Aaron participated in it also, then he got it, at least, then he got it. But then the difference is it went away from him momentarily. Unlike Miriam, ended up suffering from saras for a week. So the Gemara says, Tanya Commander Omar Af Aaron Itzara. In fact, we learn a Braisa like the opinion, like Rabbi Akiva, who says that Aaron also got Tzaras. Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, Vayifen Aaron and Miriam Behinim Itzaras. Aaron turned to Miriam, and behold, she had Tzaras. Tana, and we learn in a Braisa, what's this word Vayifen? It could just say, Vayar Aaron Behinim Itzaras. So it means, Shaponim Itzarato means that he turned away from his Tzaras, that immediately he was healed. So he was struck with Tzaras momentarily to show that he's also wrong for speaking Lashon Hara against Moshe, but then immediately he was healed, as opposed to Miriam, who began the whole thing, then she ended up having it for a week. Well, that's true, right? So that's what we're saying, that Aaron bore a certain responsibility for it as well. There was an interesting point that one of the Mefarshim says, I think it's Ben Yehoyada, says that that Aaron had the source of learning Torah, therefore that helped counteract that, but he didn't have to have the tzaras very long. Miriam didn't have that source, because after all, women don't have a mitzvah of learning Torah, so therefore she had to deal with it more long term. So, but in any case, the point is Rabbi Huda ben Beseda again is arguing with Rabbi Akiva and saying nothing new. So the Gemara continues in this vein, speaking of tzaras, speaking of people who got tzaras, we know that at one point Moshe also got tzaras. Back in Parashas Shemos, where Hashem shows him various signs to demonstrate to the Jewish people, and one of them is that his hand got tzaras and then it disappeared. So that's what Gemara is going to talk about now. Anybody who suspects people, anyone who suspects ksherim, innocent people, ends up getting punished on his own body. Because you have Moshe says to Hashem, they're not going to believe me. And now Hashem knows good and well that the Jewish people are going to trust Moshe. So Hashem says to Moshe, Elohim ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. I want you to see the difference. These Jewish people, not only they're believers, they're the sons of believers, meaning that their ancestors, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, all believed and trusted in me. Va'ata ein seif kolahamin. As opposed to you yourself, you're going to end up showing a lack of trust in Hashem. Hey ma'aminim d'chtiv v'yamin on. They believe in me because after all, the pasuk ends up saying that when Moshe came to them, the people believed. B'nei ma'aminim, because we find by Avraham, v'hemin b'Hashem, that when Hashem told Avraham that he's going to have children and they're going to inherit Eretz Yisrael, then he trusted in Hashem. After in Seif Kalahamin, on the other hand, Hashem is telling him, you're going to see, there's going to come a point when you don't believe, Shenema, Yam lehem antim b'vagayma, because by the story, when Moshe hit the rock, instead of speaking to it, and Hashem tells him, because you didn't believe in me. So whatever exactly, you have many different explanations, what exactly the nature of his mistake was, but the Torah characterizes it as that he had a lack of belief at that moment in Hashem, a lack of trust in Hashem. So therefore, don't go accusing the Jewish people of that when you yourself are going to end up doing the same thing yourself. So now Maushar discusses that, first of all, the reason why the Gemara gets into this whole drasha is because among all the signs Hashem is giving Moshe, why does he have to, of all things, give him a sign involving his hand getting tzaras? The other two signs that he gave him, that the stick will turn into a snake, and that they'll pour water on the ground and it'll turn into blood, those don't involve Moshe's actual body. So why does there need to be one that involves Moshe's actual body? So the reason is because he suspected them unjustly, Lashon Hara, like you said. Marsha says, after all, you have to wonder, really, what did Moshe do wrong? Hashem knows they're going to trust him. Okay, but he doesn't know yet that they're going to trust him. Isn't it legitimate for him to ask, what if they don't? After all, I mean, when a Navi comes, you have to ask him for signs, unless the Rambam says, unless you have a previous Navi who vouches for him. And the fact is, when does the pasuk say Vayamin Am? First, it says Vayasa Oisis La'inayam. He did the signs in front of the people, and then it says Vayamin Am. So, on the face of it, you see they trusted him only because of the signs. So, doesn't Moshe have a good point to begin with? I need signs in order to demonstrate to them that I'm legitimate. So Maharsha explains that like this. Hashem told Moshe, it's not so much that you need signs. What you need is you'll say pokad pokadti, and the Zkenim have a Masurah that goes back to Yaakov Avinu and then back to Yosef, those will be the words that the actual Goyal comes and says. So now that Hashem has told that to Moshe, then Moshe has no business saying I need signs to show them. Hashem has already told them that you'll go to them and you'll say pokad pokadti, and that's enough. So now, therefore, that's what the Gemara is saying, that now Hashem holds that against Moshe. Maharsha goes on to bring from the Medrash that the three signs that Hashem gave Moshe correspond to the three others. That's what we're saying over here in the Gemara, that they're b'nei ma'aminim. They have this trust in Hashem from their ancestors about the words pokad pokadti. So that's what's going on over here. That Hashem is telling Moshe, you have no business saying that you need that you need signs, because after all, they're going to believe once you say pokad pokadti. Different other points over here. one of the Mephoshim says over here that it may be that the simple people needed the signs. The Skanim didn't really need them. They trusted him based on saying Pocket Pakati. So therefore, the fact that it says in the Pasuk that he did the signs and then the people believed, that doesn't necessarily show they wouldn't have believed him without them. The Hamun Am maybe, but the Skanim already were believing him without that. Why Taka? What's the idea behind Achoshe B'Kshedim Loike B'Gufoi? So the Chassam Sofer talks about an idea. He says usually Hashem judges a person l'kachschus, and usually therefore Hashem doesn't right away go punish a person on his body. As we know, for example, usually by tzaras it starts out with a person's house and then his clothing, and only then it ends up going to his body. But when a person is choshed b'kshedim, so therefore he's not judging others l'kachschus. Mida k'neged mida, the Eibushter doesn't judge him l'kachschus either, and starts right away with his body, as we find here with Moshe Rabbeinu. Changes the onig into a nega. Yeah, Yun Yaakov says something somewhat similarly over here, that when a person treats kshedim and trusts them properly, then it means that he himself, it means that he comes from a tip of kshedim. It shows that he comes from legitimate Jewish stock, and therefore the Eibushter is not going to try to harm his body right away. Mashenkin, when a person is choshed with kshedim right away, so it shows that his own source of existence kind of deserves to be struck right away, and therefore he gets struck directly on his body. So the Gemara says, "Mimai deloka." So where do we actually see that Moshe was punished with saras? Hashem tells him, "Put your hand into your bosom, into a fold of your clothes," and he took it out, and it had saras in it. There's a medrash someplace that says that people sometimes would make, some of the Jews in the Midbar would make fun of Moshe and say that his family, he's from a family of Mitzrayim, and for that some of them were punished with saras. So why would they call them a family? Because we see that every member of the family at one point had saras, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. So therefore, like, they had a certain basis for the slur against Moshe. But Hashem took up Moshe's cupboard and showed them that. Yeah. Anyway, the Gemara continues. Omar Rava v'itamer Rav Yosi v'Rav Chanina. Rava says, or some say Rav Yosi v'Rav Chanina says, Mida tova maheres lovi mimidas peronis. When Hashem shows a good mida, when Hashem is going to give a reward or taking away a punishment, it comes faster than the midas peronis, than the punishment. Because when it comes to punishment, when it comes to Moshe getting the tzaras, the passage says by Yetzia, he took his hand out of his bosom, and behold, his hand was covered with tzaras like snow. So in other words, only when he took it out, then the tzaras came on it. On the other hand, when it comes to the good midah of the tzaras going away, the pasuk says, he took it out of his bosom, and behold, that it had returned to be like normal flesh, implying even while it was still inside the fold of his clothes, it already had come back to normal. And then when he took it out, it was already back to normal. So therefore, we see that the tzaras came with a delay, whereas the going away with tzaras went away right away.
What's the equation that Rashi brings in the Talmud?
That's exactly, it's based on this Gemara. That same thing. That's something else. That's what we're talking about when the Midah Tova, that's the Gemara brings that in Soita, yeah, but Rashi brings it in Chumash, yeah, that we're talking about the amount of good that Hashem gives is 500 times of the Poronis. We learn that from Miriam because she waited around for Moshe well, we learn that actually from the fact that it says in the Aseret Hadibros, it says that those who anger Hashem punishes them up to the fourth generation, but then that Hashem does kindness for up to 2,000 generations, so therefore we got 500. On the same token, yeah, Tosfos points out when the Mishnah says in Sota that because in the Schus, because Midah k'neged Midah, because Miriam waited around for Moshe when he was in the Nile, therefore in return the Jewish people waited for her for a week. Tosfos calculates that she must have been waiting there around 15 or 20 minutes, because 500 times that equals 1 week. But here we're talking about the fact that it's not just the amount, the respective amounts, we're talking about how fast it comes. So Moshe didn't get the tzaras until he actually pulled his hand out of his bosom, out of the fold of his clothing, as opposed to the tzaras disappeared when it was already inside his clothing. So Marsha explains we're talking over here about a tzaddik. In other words, Hashem waits to punish them, but he brings them the tov right away. He mentions this point about the 500, but he says that's as far as amounts. You were talking about how fast it comes. So it all has to do with, again, Moshe needs these signs. He says he needs the signs because that people should believe that he's a Navi. Now, what if they think that he's doing it with magic, the way that Paro's magicians did, for example, or the way that Paro himself and his magicians thought for a while? So therefore, when we see that with Kishuf, it's not that way. When something happens, for example, a person would get Saras or would disappear because of Kishuf, there wouldn't be the good comes faster than the bad. They would both come at the same speed. So therefore, by showing that the good comes first, that demonstrated that it was Min HaShemayim.
Sorry, but the fact that there was Saras, doesn't that, for the benefit of people that saw that the Bechir HaAdam was punished, they can watch it
harder? Yeah, that's also a lesson for them, sure. Yeah. Even Yaakov points out, I mean, the point is, Poronus comes as a punishment for Averus. Hashem wants to give even Rishoyim a chance to do Tshuva. So unlike Marsho, who says we're talking specifically about Tzadikim, Iyun Yaakov learns we're talking about Rishoyim as well. Hashem gives them a chance to do Tshuva, therefore he doesn't punish them right away, as opposed to Midah Tova comes quickly, so that way the Midah Sadin doesn't come and argue that the person doesn't deserve it. So therefore it happens faster.
Yeah, it sounds to me like Mashiach can clarify it.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Okay. The Gemara continues. Another example of something happening faster than expected. And when Moshe goes to do the signs in front of Paray, so the pasuk describes Aaron throws down his staff, it becomes a snake. All the magicians do the same thing, and then by Yivla Mate Aaron et Matosam, Aaron's staff swallowed up their staves. So Amar Abulaz and Nes Besech Nes, it was a nest within a nest, because after Aaron's staff had turned back into a staff, into a stick, then it swallowed all the snakes. So this is not only that it would have been a nest enough if his snake had swallowed all the other snakes, but that it turned back into a stick and then swallowed them. That's a nest within a nest. That's how Rashi learns. Marsha learns a little bit different. The fact that one snake swallows another, that's not really considered a nest at all. The two nissim rather are, number one, that when it was a stick, it swallowed all of them. And number two, that it didn't become any fatter after that. A snake swallows another snake, it's going to be fatter after that, but here it didn't. So that would be the nest besides nest. Well, because otherwise the pasuk would have said vayivla. It didn't have to say vayivla es matosem. It could have said, first of all, it could have said vayivla tanin Aaron, but it could have just said vayivla without saying mate Aaron. So therefore, we learn that it actually turned back into a stick. What's the connection between this and what we said before? So the Rif explains over here that it's related to this idea of midat tovah maheres love. So again, the staff became a snake only when Pyre threw it down onto the ground. On the other hand, for it to turn back into a stick, which is a midah tova, that had happened. It did it even before Aaron picked it back up. Even before he picked it back up, it had already turned back into a stick. And then on top of that, there was a nest that swallowed all the other sticks. So therefore, it relates to this point about that midah tova comes earlier than midah sporanus. The Gemara goes on to talk about, for a little further in the Perek, about where we know that there are 39 malachas, 39 obvious malachas. So Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Rebbe Omer, the pasuk says Ela Hadvarim at the beginning of Parshas Vayakel. So it could have said Dvarim, it could have said Dvarim. Instead, it says Hadvarim, and not only that, it says Ela Hadvarim. So the word Dvarim implies two, because Miut Rabim Shnayim. Hadvarim implies one other one. So therefore, that gives you a third one. And the word Ela is Gematria 36. So 36 plus 3 equals 39. Ela Shloshim Matisha Malachas Shenemim L'Moshe Misinai. So therefore, that hints the 39 obvious Malachas that were given to Moshe at Har Sinai. The Yerushalmi actually has a different way of darshaning it. The Yerushalmi says you don't even need the words, the word Hadvarim. The word Ela itself, many times we find Chazal darshan a hey and a ches interchangeably. They look very similar, and in the original pronunciation of them, they're also very similar. Listen to how a Sephardi pronounce a ches deep in the throat. It's very much like a hey. So therefore, the Yerushalmi says you can darshan the word Ela as if it was written Elech with a ches. And there you go. Aleph Lamed Ches equals 39 without even needing Hadvarim at all. There's an explanation from Levi Yitzchak that Rebbe's father was featured in Parshas Vayakel and then in the Rebbe Levi Yitzchak column in Chayenu that the miluyim of Hashem's names, the Shema, Shem Ban, etc., the total number of letters in those four miluyim totals up to 39. Most of the miluyim have 10, one of them has 9, and therefore that's the marker for the concept that you have 39 avos melachos in the physical world that the Eibishter created. Okay. The Mishnah goes on to say, Kosev a Mishnah, Moshe Chai Vazer Potter, that if a person hands something, or that if a person hands something from, let's say, from one porch to another on the same side of the street, even though it's above 10 tefachim, then he would be Chayev. But v'ham zodek, but if he throws it from one porch to the other, then potter. Shekachoy sabo it's a levim b'cholo, because that's the way the levim did. The Gemara describes that they would have one wagon parked behind another, which is the equivalent of having two houses or two porches on the same side of the street, and they would pass the kroshim along the length of one wagon, and then pass them along to the other to put them in place on the wagon. They wouldn't throw them again because they were too heavy. So therefore, we have and all of this was above 10 tefachim, which is the wagon. The height of the wagon was more than 10 tefachim off the ground. So there we see that even though above 10 tefachim in Rosh Hashanah Rabbim is usually considered makom patur, but not as far as handing something from one porch or one elevated area or whatever across to another one on the same side of the street. So agav zem afarish begom ma'isam mishkan. So in the course of that, the Gemara discusses the structure of the Mishkan. The Gemara goes into a long discussion about the size and shape of the Kroshim. For example, it has the Gemara has a discussion, has a machlokas about were the Kroshim the same width from top to bottom, or did they taper towards the top? And the Gemara discusses on that basis, how were they laid out on the wagons? If you say that they tapered, how did they put them on so that you don't have the heavier ends are more on one side and then they would be unstable. So the Gemara gets into a whole discussion about that. And then at the end of it, turn up on and we learn in a braisa, charutzim hoyu kroshim. The kroshim were they were notched at the bottom. Meaning, how did they do? So you have the kroshim. They had the kroshim were held up by the adonim, the silver sockets. So the way they did it is they carved at the bottom of each keresh, they carved out the area around and left a peg sticking out in the middle, and that peg would fit into the socket. Each keresh actually had two pegs like that, and that way you had two sockets per keresh. So charutzim hoyu kroshim. So the kroshim were made like that, with the bottom of it notched like that. You have sort of like a notch between the two pieces that stick out. V'chalulim hoyu adonim. The adonim, the silver sockets were hollow. Each of them had a hole in the middle for the protruding piece from the keresh to stick into it. The nirin krosin balolois kekoychavim berakia, and then when you look at the top of the Mishkan, when you look at the ceiling, the krosim, the hooks that held together, you had the two sets of urias, five and another five, that were held together with golden hooks that went through loops. So those golden hooks looked were inserted into the loops. They looked like the stars in the heaven. So Marashar explains, in other words, the idea behind it. The Mishkan is meant to represent the world. Now, in fact, it represents the three levels of the world. You have the physical world that we live on. You have the world of the stars and planets and whatnot, and then you have above that you have the world of the Malachim. So each component of the Mishkan represented one of those three. The Chotzer represents the world that we live in. The Mishkan with its curtains represents the world of the stars and planets. And then you have what's within the Mishkan, that's the actual structure of the Mishkan itself, the Kroshim and the Urias and whatnot. And then what you have inside the Mishkan, the Kalim over there, represents the world of the Malachim. That's why you have the Shechinahs resting on there of the Kruvim. So therefore, so we're saying that the same way as the heaven, so to speak, stands on pillars which hold it up. Gemara and Chagiga talks about how many pillars the world stands on, etc. So in the same way, you had pillars over here of the Mishkan, and above them you had the curtains spread out. So now you have the hooks in the curtains resembled the stars, just like you have the stars in the sky, because that aspect of the Mishkan represented the heavens. and the pillars that hold them up. So we turn it up on, and we learn in a braisa more about the construction of the Mishkan. The bottom layer of curtains of the Mishkan were made out of those four materials: tchelas, blue dyed wool, purple dyed, crimson dyed, and sheish, and linen. The ones above them were made out of goat hair. But there's greater chokhma regarding what it says about the upper layer more than you have in the bottom layer. By the bottom layer, the ones made out of the three kinds of wool plus linen, it says every wise-hearted woman spun them with her hands. So in other words, they spun the threads and made the fabric in the usual way. The ilabal yonis ksiv. But by the upper layer, it says, all the women whose heart lifted them up with chachma, tovu seizim, spun the goats, the tani, mishum Reb Nechemia, and we learn in a braisa in the name of Reb Nechemia that means shetovu or shotuf beizim, means that the hair was actually still attached to the goats. Shetuf shel izim, the Gemara sometimes uses to mean goat skin with the hair still attached. The tovu min izim, and it was spun while it was still on the goat's back. So that took tremendous chachma, much more so than the other kind of spinning. There's a sicha, the Rashi brings that on the pasuk. There's a Rashi sicha where the Rebbe analyzes why taka, what was the point of the women doing that. And the point is, first of all, this way the hair comes out better quality because it still has the pliability that's still more pliable and softer when it's attached to the animal and still is getting vitality from the animal more than when you cut it off. So okay, with the wool they couldn't really do that because the wool had to be dyed, but with the goat hair, since it anyway didn't need to be dyed, then they figured they have the skill, they should do that. And the deeper idea that Eber talks about it is that this way these curtains of the Mishkan would consist not only of domin but also not only of Domim and Semeach, but also of Chai, something that was actually attached to the living animal when they brought it and prepared it for the Mishkan.
Is there something about Tumah also by you doing while it's on the goat's back?
Well, it wouldn't be Makabal Tumah, but that wouldn't be Makabal Tumah. And I think that Rebbe does bring in a footnote over there that there are some Mephoshim who understand that might have been another reason why they did it that way. In case any of them are Tumah, then yeah, they wouldn't be able to be Matameh again. Yom Yom Mashiach of Geula, Yud Ches Ir, like Boimer. So in Yemosim Mashiach, we know it'll be a Siruach, and Siruach HaTuma Avim in Oretz. Hashem says, I'll remove the spirit of impurity from the world. So now, Chazal say on that you have the expression in Hazinu, Machatzti Vani Erpa. Literally, Machatzti means I wound, and then Vani Erpa, and I heal. But the Medrash explains that the word Machatzti is also in Lashon Mechitza. I made a Mechitza between the upper worlds and the lower worlds. Right now, the entities in the upper worlds live forever. For example, the Malachim and the stars and planets and whatnot, and the ones down below die. La'asid Lavei, Hashem says, I will heal that Mechitza, and that Mechitza will no longer be needed. So now, Rav Shimon ben Yochai, who was the source of the revelation of the secrets of Torah, was Mevaro, that Mechitza. So he started that process, and that the main dealer will exist, loss of love, right? Because Rashbi had shining in him the most perfect light, the Ur Shamashiach, and therefore he was able to begin the process of breaking down that Mechitza. Halacha, continuing with the halachas about things that a person sees and makes a bracha on. We talked before about making a bracha on thunder and on lightning. So if you have the same storm is still going on, the clouds haven't dissipated, then you say one bracha for the thunder and lightning. You don't say again and again. If the clouds cleared and now you have clear and you have clear sky, and then it became cloudy again, and you have a new storm, then you would make a new bracha. Now, you also don't make a bracha on lightning when you just see, sometimes you see lightning without thunder. Sometimes you just have like heat lightning. That's not really considered lightning, and you don't make a bracha on that. Another halacha, when you see a rainbow, you make a bracha. You're not supposed to stare at the rainbow, because the Gemara explains the Shekhinah appears in the rainbow. Yechezkel, in his vision of the Merkabah, compares the glory of the Shekhinah to the rainbow. So we understand that Hashem's Shekhinah appears in it, and therefore you shouldn't stare at it. another din when you see ocean, when you see oceans or mountains that are famous for their height, then you say oisamais bereshis on those.
If you're flying over a big ocean on the way to
Tarkoshi,
you should make a bracha.
Then, I guess, for you would make the bracha because you see it through the plane window. Or most, if not all of these brachas are only if you haven't seen it in 30 days. So if you've seen the ocean anytime recently, and if you live in Brooklyn, you're not that far from the ocean anyhow, then you wouldn't. Yeah,
but I don't know. It's too dirty.